That's not what I meant, the sociolinguistics of everyday conversation. Lecture 14. What to do with what you've learned.
We come now to our final lecture. What I'd like to do is review some of the key points that we've covered in all these lectures, and then address the question, what can we do with all this knowledge? How can we put it into effect in our everyday lives to actually improve communication and improve relationships? The key concept that I introduced and have used throughout the lectures is what I'm calling conversational style. Conversational style is everything about how you say what you mean. All the elements of conversational style send meta messages. These are signals that tell you how to frame the message. That is, how do you mean what you say? What do you think you're doing by talking in this way at this time? I then further broke down elements of conversational style into three categories: linguistic signals, linguistic devices, and linguistic rituals. The linguistic signals are the smallest building blocks of talk. Amplitude, that is how loudly or softly you speak. Pacing and pausing, how quickly or slowly you speak. Intonation, the music of speech. The rises and falls of combination of pitch and timing. Uses of and attitudes toward overlap, talk, silence. Linguistic devices are the larger strategies that we develop using those little bits that I have just described as linguistic signals. So they would be linguistic strategies such as questions, relative indirectness or directness, turn-taking, listenership, complaining, joking, teasing, irony, sarcasm. Topics, how and when you raise them. Stories, what can they be about? What's the point? Agonism, or ritualized opposition. And the many nonverbal correlates that I mentioned, such as eye gaze, physical distance, body orientation, touch, all the physical movements that would go under the rubric of kinesics. I use the term linguistic ritual to capture the ritual nature of much of our use of language. Our expectation that comments or interactions will go in a certain way. So it's not just a matter of being able to decode the words in a given sentence, but to see where this sentence falls in a sequence of comments or utterances. Driving the linguistic signals, devices, and rituals are the motivations or dynamics that I described as power and solidarity. That is, ways of honoring our need to be connected to each other or our involvement, but also honoring and observing and negotiating the various hierarchical or power relationships. Meta-messages are responded to on an emotional level. For an example, a teacher of English as a second language had the experience, he had been talking to his class about the emotional response that we all tend to have to the use of certain intonational contours. And he was alerting them to the fact that when they use the intonational patterns of their original language in the English language, the impact may be something different than what's intended. And he gave the example of German intonation, that many Americans hear a kind of standard German intonation as rather peremptory, even though in German, it wouldn't be heard that way. And he had a German student in the class who at that point raised his hand and said, "Give us perhaps an example." And that, in fact, was an example of what he had just been saying. And the teacher commented that he felt his ire rise, that the student was demanding that he give an example. And so here he was saying that he himself knew that the intention of this intonational contour was not to be peremptory, and yet his reaction was emotional. He felt his back up. When styles are relatively similar, you're pretty safe in assuming that others mean what you would mean if you spoke in that way in that context, and that's what most of us do when we talk to each other. But when styles differ, this assumption may not be accurate, and mutual frustration can result. People don't think in terms of style, but rather personality, ability, intentions. Or if you see the person as representing a particular group, we think in terms of group stereotypes. I also introduced the concept of complementary schismogenesis, and that's the process by which things often get worse rather than better. It's a process by which, when styles differ, each person's style can drive the other to ever more extreme expressions of the differing behavior. Another concept that I introduced was participant structure. That refers to the rights and obligations about who can and should get to talk and who controls the rights and obligations to talk. Given the dynamics that I was referring to as power and solidarity, we face a paradox when we communicate. We're always balancing the need to show connection or involvement and the need to negotiate our relative status so that we don't feel too imposed on by others. But anything we say to honor involvement can be taken as an imposition of status, in other words, a violation of the desire not to be imposed on. And anything we say to honor others' desire not to be imposed on can be taken as a failure of involvement. So to give just a really quick example, if you have a friend who has had something negative happen to them, say they failed a test or didn't get a job that they wanted or have suffered some personal loss, you really have a dilemma. If you express concern by calling attention to it, that shows involvement. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that you failed the test, that you didn't get the job. And maybe a couple days later, you're wondering again, should I say, are you still feeling bad about that? How are you doing with that? This could be appreciated as a show of involvement and caring, but it also could be seen as a kind of expression of power. In other words, you're reminding that person that they have this terrible thing happen to them. So you're reminding them of their one-down position and making them feel bad about it. So, okay, you might decide, I'm not going to mention it. I don't want to rub his nose in it. I don't want to make him feel even worse. That could be seen as a failure of involvement. He may think you've forgotten about it. You're only thinking about yourself. You're not even concerned. So there's always that dilemma, and there's no one thing that's always going to be right. Anything you do to show involvement could be a violation of the need to be left alone. Anything you do to leave the person alone can be seen as a failure of involvement. So those are some of the principles of conversational style that I laid out in these lectures. Now, what do we do with this knowledge? I want to acknowledge right here that talking about style is not self-evidently and automatically appealing to everyone. Some people see this as simply avoiding the reality of psychological processes. For example, if you recall the example I gave of yogurt dressing, where two men who were partners were preparing dinner, and one suggested making dressing. And in the end, they had an argument about it. My reading of that was that the argument was in part a result of style differences, that the partner who had said yogurt dressing, what else, was using a kind of irony, a self-irony. And so when he said yogurt dressing, he was really just implying, I'm unimaginative. If you ask me, I'm going to say yogurt dressing, make whatever you like. And it was a process of complementary schismogenesis that made him more and more insistent in saying, make whatever you like, so that he ended up saying, make yogurt dressing, and then throw it out. After I presented this example in one public lecture, someone approached me afterwards who happened to be a psychiatrist, or maybe didn't happen to be a psychiatrist, and he said, well, what you're missing here is he was hostile. So I had not succeeded in convincing this audience member that what was going on was a misunderstanding due to style. He really thought it was a psychological pathology. Some years ago, I appeared on a Voice of America radio show that was hosted by Arlene Francis. And I explained on that show that for many natives of New York City, talking along is a sign of connection, not interruption. That's because her show was about New York City. It was called New York, New York. Well, Ms. Francis was not convinced by my explanation of style. In fact, she commented, it's just not polite. There are no manners considered here, are there? So I redoubled my efforts to say that I understood her point of view, but manners is really a culturally relative idea that what in one culture may be considered rude in another culture may be considered polite by another system of manners. Again, I didn't convince her because when she closed the show, she said to the listening Voice of America audience all over the world, if you come to this city and you talk that way, I'll be very mad at you. And a final example of someone who was not convinced by my perspective, I had a student who was from Texas, who was a student in my class, and she wanted to share with her mother some of the insights that she was getting from the class. And I had been on a radio talk show around that time, and so she got a copy of the tape and sent it to her mother. This was before the days of email, so her mother wrote her a letter with her response to the tape. And what the mother said was, being from the North gives a very dominant viewpoint. The one thing that was never brought out was that the fact of not speaking out or interrupting is not so much culture as it is manners. And of course, the reason I never brought that out was that that was the position I was actually trying to argue against. But I give all these examples in order to acknowledge that many people will resist the explanation of style and will really just feel in their guts that their way is right, other ways are wrong, and they don't want it explained away. One reason that I think many people resist the explanation of style is that we all feel, in a way, that our way of speaking is who we are. And so we may not want to change. So, for example, one woman whose husband kept complaining that she never gave him a chance to talk said to him, well, why don't you talk over me? And he said, well, I don't want to be a competitive person. And he said, I don't want to be a competitive talker. In other words, he didn't want to be that kind of person. And yet, despite all these reasons for resisting the explanation of conversational style, I have found over the years that most people find an understanding of conversational style to be very liberating. First of all, it removes blame. If you don't know about style, blame is really all you've got. You blame the other person, you blame yourself, or you blame the relationship. I want to read a letter that I got from a copy editor. That's an editor who reads over an article as it's being prepared to go to press to fix whatever errors might be in there. So this copy editor had just been editing an article that I'd written that was going to appear in an academic journal. And the article was called New York Jewish Conversational Style. This editor lived in the Netherlands, and this is the letter that she wrote. Dear Dr. Tannen, I've just finished copy editing your article on New York Jewish conversational style, and despite the fact that it's almost midnight and I've wanted since 9:30 to crawl into bed with a cup of tea and a book rather than do what I've been doing, I feel I must send you a thank you. I'm not from New York, though I lived there for a while, but from Oregon. And I'm not Jewish, though not much of anything else either. Your article nevertheless help explains me to me, and will, I hope, help to explain me to my husband, who is inclined to tell me I talk too much and don't give other people a chance to finish what they want to say. She says in parentheses here, and having lived in Europe for the last 8 years, and I assume scaled down a bit, I tend to have the same reactions to some, though not all, Americans we meet. And that closes the parentheses. And I think what's happening here that she's referring to is the point that I made earlier, that conversational style is never absolute. It always takes on meaning in interaction with the styles of the other people that you're talking to. So when talking to her husband, she was the one who was accused of talking too much, but then she had the same reaction to other Americans. And I'll just finish what she wrote here. It's been a source of all sorts of emotions for me, ranging from defensive rage to mea culpa breast beating. And your article, though it doesn't furnish any how-to for adjusting to a quite different conversational environment, at least clues me in to some of the mechanisms at work. I wanted to read that letter because it captures how simply understanding that there is a process of conversational style going on remove some of the blame. And without knowing about it, what are you left with? Defensive rage because you know that you mean well and you're being accused of negative motives, or mea culpa breastfeeding. You think, what's wrong with me? Why am I so terrible? Here's another example of how realizing that what's at stake is conversational style can be helpful when it lifts not just the blame of yourself, but the blame of somebody else. A woman, I'll call her Maria, objected to her mother-in-law bringing her dog when she came to visit. Maria tried to politely, from her point of view, let her mother-in-law know that she shouldn't bring the dog. But the way Maria said it was the following. She said, "You shouldn't bring your dog because it's not fair to him. He gets upset. He barks at our dog, and then you have to lock him up, and so he's not comfortable." In other words, she used indirectness. She phrased it in a way that was better for the dog rather than for her. So her mother-in-law took it literally and assured her that the dog was fine. In reaction to that, Maria changed her tactic and said directly that she preferred the dog be left at home. Well, that was okay with the mother-in-law. She didn't seem to take offense, and she said okay. But, and this is what's really interesting to me, Maria resented her mother-in-law for forcing her to be rude, what she perceived as rude. She said to her husband, "Why do I have to spell things out for her?" And I find that so interesting. Very often, we're irritated by somebody else's style. I think I made this point earlier. Not just because of what we think of them, because they try it that way, but how we feel about ourselves as our styles develop in reaction to theirs. In other words, we don't like who we are in interaction with them. So Maria felt her mother-in-law was turning her into a rude person. Realizing that these were style differences made Maria rethink her moral judgment of her mother-in-law and made her realize for the first time that maybe her mother-in-law really did genuinely miss her motivation when she said, "You shouldn't bring your dog because it's not fair to him." Maybe her mother-in-law really didn't realize that that was an indirect way of saying, "I don't want you to bring the dog," because she wouldn't have communicated that way. Now, this is a particularly interesting example because both Maria and her husband and his family are Mexican-American. But Maria is first-generation Mexican-American from San Antonio, whereas her husband is third-generation from Los Angeles. And so that may have something to do with the different styles that their families had used, even though they were both Mexican-American. These examples that I've just been given are from the point of view of the one who resents someone else's style, but the one who is criticized also is liberated by understanding style. For example, an Italian-American man commented to me that it had always kind of bothered him when he was younger and he was in the military. He did what to him seemed self-evident. When he was talking to someone and made a point, he would often reach out and touch the person on the arm to make the point. And a fellow soldier once physically recoiled and said, "Stop touching me." And he felt he was even being accused in a way of something, and he never quite understood why that was until he caught on that these were different kinesic habits that were part of his conversational style but were not part of the conversational style of the other soldier. Of course, in a workplace conversation, there can be rather dire consequences if someone tends to reach out and touch more frequently than the person they're talking to expects. Remember, too, that woman who, after 40 years, suddenly understood why her college date accused it was nice having dinner with the FBI. She had had no way of understanding that other than this guy was being vicious to her for nothing she had done wrong. By the same token, someone who talks along as a form of enthusiastic listenership can be really hurt when someone snaps, "Don't interrupt, let me finish." There's nothing more disquieting than perceiving that your intentions are being misread. You know you're trying to be a good person and someone's acting as if you're trying to be a bad person. So that's another one of the many ways that simply understanding conversational style can lift some of the blame and the hurt. But understanding is really only one step. We can change our styles if we want to, once we understand the process. And by the way, I am frequently asked, can people change their styles? But I often find that what they have in mind is not changing their own styles, but sending their partners in for repair. Because so many of us feel that the way we talk is who we are, we don't really want to change as much as we wish others would change. But we can change if we feel that we're not getting the effect that we want. So understanding the processes of conversational style in itself can be a very beneficial thing. But once we have this knowledge, there are things that we can do. We can actually make changes if we want to. It's a funny thing. I'm often asked, is it possible for people to change their conversational style? I have found over time, though, that usually when people ask me that, what they have in mind is not changing their own style, but sending their partners in for repair. Because we feel that our style is who we are not quite as eager to change our own. And yet, it really does give you flexibility. When you think in terms of style, you know what to change if you want to make changes to have a different effect on the person you're talking to. And other people are more likely to change if they think in terms of style. If you're not thinking in terms of style, then if someone wants you to change your way of talking, it can feel that making that change is like an admission of fault. You're right, I'm wrong, so I'm going to change and do it your way. If you think of it in terms of style, you can make the change without feeling that you've been accused of something wrong. Here's an example. This refers to the pattern that I described in an earlier lecture, where I found in my research that girls and women at all ages are more likely to look directly at the person they're talking to, whereas boys and men at all ages often sit at angles and look around the room. I had a young woman in one of my classes who said that this really explained something that had been the source of a great deal of frustration in her relationship with her boyfriend. Sometimes she would have something she wanted to talk to him about, and she would say, you know, I want to talk to you, and he would lie down, close his eyes, and put his arm over his eyes. This would really, really upset her, and she would say, you're not listening to me, you're going to sleep. And he would say, I am listening, and they never could really work it out. When she thought about it as this style difference and realized that this was something that was quite typical of the way many boys and men listen, she talked to him about it, and they both agreed that this was really a style thing, and they weren't going to be that upset about it. And she decided that the next time this happened, she was going to be more flexible. And so a day came when she wanted to talk to him about something, and she told him as much. And he started to lie down, and then he changed course, and he sat up, and he looked at her. And she said, oh, you know, how come you're doing it differently now? And he said, now that I understand why it means something to you, I'm going to try to do it. Now, I can't guarantee that that's always going to happen, but it is much more likely to happen when the behavior was discussed in terms of conversational style. So long as she was accusing him, you're not listening, and he knew he was listening, why should he change his way of behaving? That would be like admitting a fault that he wasn't guilty of. It would be as if he was saying, yeah, I wasn't listening, and now I'm going to listen. So he wouldn't want to change if he didn't understand why she had this bizarre interpretation of his behavior. But when they talked about it in terms of style, then both were motivated to adjust to the other's style. In order to illustrate an example of the kinds of changes that one can make in style and the effects that it can have, I want to read one last field note from a student in my class. This was written by a student who had been raised in China, and this is what he wrote. One Saturday morning, George, a friend of mine, and I were sitting at a table in the cafeteria for brunch. When we were almost done, Sean, a friend of Paul's, came up and asked if she could join us. George said, of course, and introduced us to each other. As soon as Sean took her seat, she asked me where I came from. China, I said. Which one, she continued asking me, Taiwan or the mainland? Mainland China, I answered. Oh, really? I have been to both Taiwan and mainland China. Then she started telling me all about her experiences in both Chinas. I was very interested in listening to her. From then on, she kept talking almost all the time without a break, giving us a vivid narration of all sorts of interesting stories. As both George and I had already finished by this time, George had to excuse himself to leave. I, however, stayed on. After another while, although I was interested in her chat, I remembered about my pile of homework that had to be done, so I said I had to leave too. She said she had also finished, so we walked out of the cafeteria together. All the while she was talking. By the time we had to separate, we stood there and she went on talking. Finally, when I realized that she had no intention of stopping, I apologized once again and said that I really had to go. We exchanged our telephone numbers and promised that we should get together sometime. Not long after, again in the cafeteria, she suddenly showed up and took a seat in front of me when I was eating there alone. She started her chat right away. She had run out of things about China, and the topics now were very wide-ranging. I can no longer remember all the contents of her talk. We were eating together, and she was meanwhile talking all the time. When I needed to go to the serving area to get some more food, I was waiting for her to stop just for a second so that I could have a chance to say, "Excuse me for just a minute." Unfortunately, she never stopped, not even for a second. Then I had an idea. I took up my plate and held it in my hand to show her that I was really ready to go get some food, in the hope that she herself would offer to say, "Oh, you want to get some more food? You can go ahead." Same result. No feedback, and the chat went all the way on. Finally, I said, "I'll be back," and walked away, breaking her talk off rather rudely. So again, he felt he'd been forced to be rude. However, she was very nice and did not take offense. She was too nice. While I was standing in the line in the serving area, she came after me and went on talking. We ran into each other a couple of times after that. She wanted to talk, but I did not allow it, saying, "Sorry, I'm on my way to, I'm in a rush." She kept saying, "Call me, call me. We should get together sometime." And I kept saying, "Yes, I will, yes, I will." She wanted to get together to show me something that I showed great interest to when we talked to each other at the first meeting. We finally agreed that we should plan to get together after the summer vacation started. You clearly get the impression from the field note thus far that Sean is simply a pathological talker. There was no way to stop her. And as you could see from his description, this student had absolutely no interest in seeing her anymore. There's no way he wanted to be friends with her. Well, it was somewhere in there that he took the course Cross-Cultural Communication. And this is what he writes later in his field note. "Sometime in last month, October, I was surprised to run into Sean and George together on campus again." They had both graduated. "At this time, I was taking Dr. Deborah Tennant's course, Cross-Cultural Communication, and had already realized to some extent about the problems between Sean and me. So I took the chance to experience a different conversational style. After fair weather talking, I initiated the conversation first by telling her all my experiences in Europe this past summer. She was very interested and related my experiences to her own in Europe. Whenever she cut me off, I immediately cut her off in return. Whenever she raised her voice, I raised mine even higher. I tried by all means to dominate the conversation. As a result, we got along extremely well this time. Once again, I really had a lot of homework to do, and I said at the start that I had to leave soon. But we turned out having stood in front of the library talking for 3 hours. We had such a good time talking that we became oblivious to our surroundings. Both our voices were so high and loud, with my funny foreign accent on top of that, the people who have passed in front of the library several times already were curious if we were all right. A friend of George's asked him, 'Hey, George, what's going on here?' George and Sean did take me out to a cafe the following week. Now Sean and I are good friends as we enjoy talking to each other." I love that example because it captures how wrong an impression can be, even when it could never seem that any other interpretation is possible. How else to understand Sean's behavior other than that she was a compulsive talker? And yet when this young man changed his behavior, he suddenly had a completely different view of Sean. And most important to keep in mind, he was able to become friends with her. So people that you could have no hope of friendship with, suddenly you actually can have a relationship with. And think about the implications of this in the workplace or in public life, where it's essential to work with a wide range of people. You can't always choose who your colleagues are. And so being able to be flexible in your conversational style makes it possible for you to work productively with a wider range of people. To sum up then, understanding conversational style helps you understand what happens to you every day in your interactions with other people. Just this knowledge alone can be a great relief. But with the knowledge, You also can change interactions if you like. You can talk about communication. You can say, for example, when I say, I'm sorry, I'm not apologizing, I'm just taking your feelings into account. You can say, when I talk about a problem, I'm not looking for a solution, I just want to talk about it. There are all kinds of accommodations you could make. For example, if there's a couple of whom one wants to talk about the day in detail, the other wants to kind of take a certain amount of time to just read the newspaper and unwind before talking, you might say, okay, we'll spend 10 minutes talking and then you unwind, or I'll give you 10 minutes to unwind and then we can talk. All of these accommodations can be worked out much more successfully if you discuss it on the level of style and you're not exchanging blame and accusations. I found over the years that people are extremely creative about finding ways to improve communication once an understanding of conversational style gives them the tools to make the changes. They know what it is that they need to change or can try changing to get a different result. At bottom, understanding conversational style is about understanding human diversity. It's about respect for other people, their individuality, and how that individuality plays out when we talk to each other.
Now that you've completed this course, be sure to test your comprehension by taking the final exam. You'll find the exam on this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com. If you enjoyed this program, the Modern Scholar series from Recorded Books offers courses in a variety of subject areas taught by the world's greatest professors. Call 1-800-636-3399 or visit the course webpage for a free catalog. This course, produced by John J. Alexander, is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books, LLC. The lecture text is copyrighted 2004 by Deborah Tannen. The lectures were recorded under the direction of Matthew Kavnar.